This is going to be long. But do you know what else was long? The Great Recession was long. It seems like, in one way or another, the Great Recession just stole my youth. It started when I was just at the beginning of a none-too-promising career as an English teacher in Madrid, and it seems to have just dragged on forever. I got about 3,000 words into this text before realizing I had no idea when or how the Great Recession had even ended. I'm Daniel Welsh, and this is the Spain to Go podcast, the best podcast for all things Spain. Today, we are revisiting the Great Recession. Are you ready? Let's go. These days in Spain, there's talk of a new recession. I'm recording this in August 2022. Inflation is over 10%, and even though employment is still high, people are starting to worry about the economy. The prices of gas and electricity have been going up for a while, and with the war in Ukraine continuing, and Russia in charge of a lot of Europe's gas supply, it looks like we're in for some volatility. How much volatility is anybody's guess? But it's all got me thinking about the Great Recession, the old crisis from back in the early 2000s. Because if a new recession is coming, I can take comfort in the fact that this isn't exactly my first rodeo. This time will be different, of course. History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. So what happened back in the aughts? Where did my youth go exactly? I guess it's story time, and we will begin in 2005 with the Spanish bonanza. When I moved to Spain in late 2004, things were booming. My first job search took me exactly 3 days in the cold week between Christmas and New Year's Day. I remember leaving my rented room in Lucero on Monday morning, Callejero in hand, having just copied a list of language schools from the Yellow Pages. You remember Callejeros? The novel-sized books of street maps you needed to find anything in the time before GPS. Those were indeed the days. By Thursday of that week, I had an offer for a job teaching English in a school in Puerta del Sol. The boss told me I could start after the holidays. I didn't know it at the time, but I was going to be spending 10 pretty eventful years right there at Kilometro Cero, the metaphorical center of Spain. Madrid was in full real estate boom at the time. The whole city was under construction, and a lot of the workers were born somewhere else. This was also one of the peak years for immigration. People were optimistic, taking out mortgages on fifth-floor flats in new neighborhoods, popping up all around the city, and bragging about how the value of their homes were increasing by the minute. The price of real estate always goes up. Everyone knows that. When I started working in the language school, I soon found that my coworkers were all pretty sure they could skip off to better jobs at any moment. A few of them even did. But I felt pretty good with what I was earning. This is coming from the US, where I'd been working as a barista for $7 an hour plus tips. That job involved mopping and washing dishes, and I'd always smell like burnt coffee when I got home after my shifts. Now, in Madrid, I was being paid 11 euros just to talk to people. The euro in those days was around €1.30, and I was feeling rich when I got my envelope full of cash at the end of the month. Then, feeling even richer when I gave private lessons and was paid in crisp tax-free 20s. That was like $26 an hour, and I repeat, all I had to do was talk to people. Ah, to be 22 again and bursting with youthful exuberance. The fact that technically I was an illegal immigrant in a job with limited prospects for the future didn't bother me at all, because, like I said, I was 22. I figured I'd probably die by age 27 anyway, so why worry? In the meantime, in the few years before I was certain to die rock starishly on the floor of my rented room, I could focus on what really mattered. My barely formed brain was pretty clear on what that was. It could only be one thing, in fact. Sleeping with the locals. Long story short, I had some fun. You can check out my article about dating Spanish girls for more about that. I believe it's an episode of this podcast also, approximately episode 8. So, I had some fun, but I didn't die. I turned 27 in 2009. Incidentally, the year that Spain entered the Great Recession. Maybe it was time to make some sort of life plan. The recession, though, took some time in coming. I remember reading some headlines in the summer of 2007 when I was up in Santander staying with some Spanish friends. It was Bear Stearns this and Northern Rock that. I didn't have much clue about the economy. I'd never previously heard of Bear Stearns. And at that point, it didn't really seem like I should care. I put it out of my mind and did my job. I didn't own any real estate, after all, or much of anything else. My most valuable possession at that point was probably a pair of shoes. Another year passed. I spent a summer dating a French girl who was an Esperantist and had a lanolin allergy. Sleeping two people in a twin bed in summer without aircon is something I don't recommend, although it's somewhat better if one of the people has perky boobs and a cute French accent. In any case, it had never occurred to me that I could just walk into a shop and buy a bigger mattress. Presumably, the hedge fund guys were running around in full panic mode around that point. You can and should read the book The Big Short by Michael Lewis for the whole story. But I knew nothing about that at the time. I was, as the saying goes, just having some fun, and mostly avoiding thinking of myself as a full adult. After that summer, the French girl went back to France, as French girls tend to do, and I went back to work. A coworker bought a flat in Vallecas, not the most glamorous neighborhood of Madrid. I know because I lived there too by that time. He and his partner paid 250,000 euros for the flat, and one day, in probably 2007, he bragged that the value of his home had already doubled. "In a few years, we'll be able to sell it for 700,000," he said. I had the feeling, even at that time, that he was very wrong about that. After all, he was working with me, getting paid with an envelope full of 50s and 20s as well. The Big Short talks about U.S. banks giving loans to undocumented immigrant waiters who couldn't even make the first payment. Here in Spain, things didn't get that bad, but they were close. How was the real estate market supposed to continue growing when the average salary was less than 22,000 euros a year? How was the government going to collect enough taxes when half the economy was underground? I guessed we would soon find out. Finally, the proverbial shit hit the fan with the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008. Some of my more communist-leaning coworkers declared, over sour breakroom coffee, that capitalism was over. But was it? A new academic year was starting, so every morning I'd roll out of bed, pull on my ultra-valuable pair of Doc Martens, and head off to the language school. If this was the end of capitalism, why was I still going to work? Why was I paying rent and shopping for lentils at the supermarket? This was long after I'd given up, personally, on seeing the world as a class struggle between bourgeoisie and proletarians. Because what was I in that little world view? Illegal immigrant, English teacher, aspiring writer. Not bourgeois, certainly. But I couldn't really identify as one of Marx's proletariat either. Most of the people I know who did identify as Marx's proles were mostly interested in cashing unemployment checks. As an immigrant with no right to unemployment, I couldn't really relate. My highest aspiration at that point was actually to get legal with the Spanish government so I could start paying taxes, plus enjoy some of the free health care everybody was always talking about. I guess I'm a terrible revolutionary, but I decided capitalism was probably not over and went back to work teaching the present perfect to my groups of people from Spain and also literally everywhere else. One of my private students at that time was a countess from the Spanish aristocracy. She found me through a classified ad. Remember those? I'd text Profesor Nativo de Inglés to some special phone number, and the next morning my ad would appear printed in the newspaper. My phone would ring a few times throughout the day, and hopefully I'd end up with a couple of new customers. Anyway, the Countess lived in a huge house on Calle Velázquez. Sorry for my pronunciation of those Spanish Z's. Like I said, she lived on Calle Velázquez, or at least spent some time there, between trips to her husband's country manor. She had a Paraguayan butler who would bring me glasses of water on a silver platter, which he held up in one white-gloved hand. Did she call him by ringing a bell, or is that the detail my brain is just adding in now that I think of it? I'm not sure. Anyway, I wasn't too impressed. Okay, that's a lie. I was very impressed. I charged the Countess 25 euros an hour, a price she loudly objected to every time she paid it. But I was unwavering. President Zapatero was assuring us that the financial meltdown was happening everywhere else, but not here in Spain. España no está en crisis, he said. España no está en crisis, he repeated. This went on for a couple of years. Except for the temporary readjustment of housing prices and the rapid doubling of the unemployment rate, he told us, Spain was fine. So surely the Countess could afford to pay me 25 euros an hour. I had expenses too, after all. Doc Martens and wine aren't free. Surely something important happened in those years, but not to me. My chronology is pretty vague and mostly based on who I was sleeping with. Eventually, the Countess gave up on English, or at least on me. I briefly dated a girl from Eastern Europe who would walk around in knee-high stiletto boots and leopard print tops. A real head-turner, that one. Then there was a Latin girl who was an ex-nun, and a Basque actress who... You know what? Forget about it. The list of girls I briefly dated in my 20s is long and fascinating, but that's not what we're here for. We're here to talk about the economy. In Spain, you're a young person until at least age 30. And I turned 30 in 2012 when the unemployment rate was hovering around 25%. I had an actual girlfriend by then, Italian girl. We could call her Marilia with a silent GL. I've probably mentioned her somewhere else. Thus ended my dating escapades along with my youth. We celebrated my 30th birthday with suckling pig at Restaurante Botín, because Hemingway. In 2012, I was still working at the same job in Puerta del Sol, and by this time, I was pretty sick of it. 7 years in, and the joy of earning 11 bucks an hour had worn off. But it didn't seem like the moment to go looking for jobs. Most of the people I knew were being fired, or going to work on promises every day that the boss would have enough money to pay them soon. My flatmate was a dentist working shifts at multiple clinics, and none of them had paid him in months. When the main place went bust, the employees just took everything they could carry away. Such stories were depressingly common. It turns out people had been getting their dental work done on credit. Now that there was no credit, most people couldn't spend 3,000 euros on a dental implant. The number of collections agencies that started advertising everywhere was outpaced only by the proliferation of pawn shops. On the other hand, the language school always had plenty of students, and I was getting paid on time. We were actually experiencing something of a boom, as people lost their jobs and had to look for something to do to improve their skills. All the architects and engineers who had been living well when the whole country was a giant construction site were now unemployed. The outskirts of Madrid and every other Spanish city I visited at the time were full of half-built housing developments that looked like they'd been abandoned by the builders. Ghost towns crisscrossed by ghost streets, relics of all that early century optimism. For a lot of people, the situation was looking dire. The immigrants were leaving and the Spaniards were trying to figure out where to go themselves when their unemployment subsidy ran out. People with master's degrees were going off to work at Starbucks in Berlin or Zara in London. Germany and the UK seemed to be doing great, actually. And here in Spain, we were 4 years into the crisis and things were getting worse every day. Oh well, better learn some English. The language school was an all-cash operation, so financially I was fine. I'd started eating horse meat as a hedge against the uncertainty of the times, but that was about it. Don't get me wrong, I wasn't getting rich. It was just that I was just as broke as I had always been, while everyone else around me was getting much broker. Also, I'd finally worked out my legal situation and become an official, tax-paying resident of the Kingdom of Spain. I had a work contract, finally, and even a health card. So despite the terrible economy, things were going well, except for the fact that the free health care was actually taking a chunk out of my paycheck in Social Security. Oh well. When I hadn't died rockstarishly at age 27, I'd looked around and decided I probably needed a plan for my life. I'd never hoped to be an English teacher forever. It seemed like a young person's game, and I wasn't going to be young much longer. How long do people live anyway? I did the math. My grandfather was 90, and my grandmother was 88. Shit. I'd better start acting like an adult. One day I asked my boss, "So, what are the chances for progressing in this industry? How do I move beyond explaining the pronunciation of beach and bitch 7 times a day for the rest of my life?" He gave a long, rambling reply that amounted to a big fat zero. There was zero hope here. No possibility for growth. This was it. 1,200 euros a month and nothing all summer long, until you're old enough to get Social Security. Either that or, you know, find a real job. Real jobs, however, were increasingly hard to come by, and anyway, I had no marketable skills. What's a guy to do? I got really interested in the economy. I read every article Morgan Housel was writing over on The Motley Fool. Then I moved on to Expansión, the Spanish business journal. I started investing in Spanish stocks, Telefónica, Mapfre, Banco Santander. Looking back, I'm impressed that I managed to start investing while earning so little. I guess the money I was saving by eating horse meat instead of beef was my seed capital. Pro tip, tell your roommates the lasagna was made with horse meat after they've eaten it, not before. The Spanish stocks, though, caused me nothing but pain. Spain's stock market, the IBEX 35, or IBEX 35 if you prefer, took a huge dive in 2009 at the same time the US market did. Then it stumbled around sideways for a few years before taking an even deeper dive in 2012. Years later, it still hasn't recovered. Today, as I'm writing this, it looks like it's trading at about half its pre-crisis highs. The economy eventually recovered, but not the stock market. A lot of this had to do with the banking sector. When suddenly nobody could afford to pay their mortgages, the banks were stuck with a lot of houses they couldn't get rid of. Sometimes people would lose their houses and be forced to pay anyway. The famous dación de pago, which people had signed up for in better times, usually without knowing what it was. I'm not even sure what we call it in English, but a friend who I ran into years later told me about how it happened to her. The bank foreclosed on her house, she moved, And a year later, they came to her and said, "Hey, listen, you still owe us 60,000 euros. It's the dación de pago." She had signed it. It was part of her mortgage. Probably a mortgage is some long document, and she had not understood every word. So now she was screwed. There was also the little matter of the Greek debt crisis. Every couple of weeks, it seems like the Greeks would threaten to default on their loans, and the whole EU would panic. It wasn't clear where this was going to end. If Greece defaulted, Spain could be next. Would we have an Argentina-style crisis with a currency worth nothing and runs on the banks? Would I soon be bartering English classes for sacks of potatoes? It seemed like anything was possible, but not in a good way. The Germans were suggesting that the Greeks sell the Acropolis to get some cash flow. The Greeks, in return, asked for $302 billion in reparations for Nazi war crimes. These were, indeed, interesting times. Over on the blog at expatmadrid.com, I've got an article called Scenes from the Great Recession, where I talk about some of the specifics of what was going on in those interesting times. The first scene is Compro Oro and low-cost everything. For several months after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, it seemed like nothing was happening in Spain. I only heard about the recession on the news. I was in Madrid, working as a teacher, like I said, and business was good. There might have been a crisis out there somewhere, but it didn't seem to be happening here. The first thing I remember actually happening on the street in my neighborhood, Vallecas, was that a lot of small businesses suddenly closed, and seemingly within days, they were replaced by pawn shops. Since then, the long lines outside cash converters have become something of an institution in Madrid. But at the time, it seemed new and exotic. Who were these people, and what was their situation? I can't imagine what it's like standing around for half the morning, only to be offered 10 euros to pawn your hairdryer or your kid's bike. But apparently, that's what people were doing. And then there were the Compro Oro places. These dedicate themselves to buying, pawning, and reselling gold jewelry, and seem to be doing a brisk business, with more of them opening up every day, even in Vallecas, which was not the most glamorous of neighborhoods. I asked around, and apparently a lot of old-school Spanish people had spent several decades buying gold, just in case. Now, they were selling it. Outside the language school where I worked, right in Puerta del Sol, there were usually half a dozen guys wearing Compro Oro sandwich boards, wandering around the plaza, handing out flyers and trying to drum up business. Another surprise was the sudden plague of Cien Montadito restaurants. Before, there had only been one or two, and I'd hated them. Suddenly, there were dozens, with more opening up every day. Cien Montaditos is just, in case you don't know, tiny sandwiches and cheap beer. The sudden appearance of hundreds of Cien Montaditos was followed by a proliferation of other low-cost restaurant chains. Old man bars would close, only to be replaced with discount paella joints. I'm not joking about discount paella. There was a buffet right around the corner from the language school. A big Dominican guy would stand around outside, wearing a sandwich board that said, "All you care to eat." Every few minutes, he'd shout, "Ay paella!" at the top of his lungs. It was the soundtrack to many an English lesson in those days. But it's hard to go wrong selling cheap beer and empty carbs to the young and broke. Let that be a reminder that every crisis brings with it an opportunity for someone. Soon after the expansion of Cien Montaditos, low-cost bars were everywhere. Everything was now low-cost because it had to be. Why? Because of, shockingly, high rates of unemployment. In 2008, when everything was going fine, unemployment was about 8%. Over the next few years, every month was another piece of bad news about the unemployment rate. It went from 8% to 10% to 15% to 20% to about 27% at the worst point of the crisis. At the beginning of each new month, the papers printed photos of the long lines outside the unemployment offices, along with the previous month's horrific jobs data. Tens or hundreds of thousands of new unemployed, month after month. Some of these people ended up eating from food banks, and they were previously middle-class people, people who did not expect anything like that to happen to them. It got to the point where I talked with my friends about it. Why hadn't society just collapsed? We all had our theories, and I guess real economists share some of them. But it boils down to a few factors. First, Spanish families tend to take care of each other. Spanish people in their 40s or 50s often have no problem moving back in with mom and dad if it'll save them a mortgage payment. My best Spanish friend described around this time the network of cousins bailing out cousins within her family. This month, Maria needs $400 to pay rent. Next month, Sonia's kid needs a laptop so he can start university. Some other cousin would step up with the money. They didn't like it, but they helped out, and things kept moving forward. Society did not collapse. Another theory as to how things kept moving forward despite 20%, 25%, or 27% unemployment is that the underground economy is huge. People work off contract all the time, and I'm sure there was even more of it during the crisis. I was doing it for the first part of my stint in Spain until 2012. I was off contract all the time. This did not appear to be a problem for the owners of any language school. The people in the government can try to stop this to some extent, I guess, but I think they're probably all hiring housekeepers that are paid in cash also. Some of them probably own construction companies with hundreds of illegal laborers. Who knows? And if they don't, their Uncle Pepe certainly does. I don't think anybody is too motivated to get rid of the underground economy. All of this leads to my third theory as to why the whole society didn't just collapse when unemployment hit 27%, and that is that government statistics are largely bullshit anyway. It was pretty common in those days to have a work contract for 10 hours a week, when in reality you were working 25. Officially, you were employed, but 2/3 of your paycheck was given to you as an envelope full of 20s and 50s on the first of the month. Multiply that by a few million people, and you'll see why a lot of people didn't believe the official statistics. And I guess I should mention, that envelope of 20s and 50s is if you were lucky, because there was also another widespread phenomenon around that time. Bosses who suddenly weren't paying anyone. One day, a guy named Paco came to English class. He was an architect. I think Paco was his real name. And the construction boom was long gone. Like many others, he was thinking about leaving the country. "How's it going, Paco?" I asked. "Bad," he replied. "My boss hasn't paid me in 3 months. He says he doesn't have any money, but then he goes and buys himself a giant new iMac computer for 3,000 euros. Apparently, the boss hadn't paid anyone. It was a small architectural studio, not a lot of work was coming in, and suddenly everyone was supposed to come in and work for free. And Paco was hardly the only one. My flatmate, who I mentioned earlier, had just graduated from dental school. He was working at 3 different clinics and wasn't being paid by any of them. A friend who worked in a gym was waiting on 6 months of back salary. In my mind, it would have made more sense to quit, but nobody seemed to be quitting. The boss was always saying, 'Yeah, it's no problem. In a few days, we'll be able to pay everyone.' and a few days was pushed back for months or years, until the companies just folded. In the meantime, people tapped their parents for money or just moved back home. People who had complained about their salaries before were suddenly saying, "Well, at least I'm lucky to have a job." And then, going to work for free, month after month. When my flatmate's dental clinic went tits up, the employees raided the break room to get even. Like I said, they carried away everything they could. My flatmate brought home a used microwave in lieu of 12,000 euros back pay. It was a pretty good microwave. It served us for years afterwards. Another scene from the Great Recession. The 15M protests in Puerta del Sol and everywhere else. One day, they were everywhere. The indignados. Indignados are just angry people, basically. They were camped out in plazas all over Spain, sitting around with signs about how they were getting screwed by their employers, or the government, or the bank that owned their mortgage. And they were probably right. But then, as now, I didn't see how sitting around was going to solve their problems. You're welcome to convince me otherwise. Send me a message. In any case, the movement had started on May 15th, 2011, with a few people camping in Puerta del Sol after confrontations with police had broken up the day's scheduled protests. Thousands more joined them over the next few days, and soon the normally chaotic area in Madrid center became a whole new style of chaotic. The plaza was filled with campers. People sitting cross-legged in circles read manifestos and debated the issues of the day. Slogans abounded. There were more slogans even than tents. One of my favorite slogans, "No hay pan para tanto chorizo." This means, well, chorizo in Spain refers to the delicious red sausage, but also it's somebody who is a small-time criminal, somebody who steals money or other things. Chorizo was what they were using to describe most of the politicians and bankers at this point. So, "No hay pan para tanto chorizo" referred to the fact that we were in a country where many were going hungry while the top of society were all criminals. No hay pan para tanto chorizo. Anyway, I didn't pay much attention. The expat community seemed to be mostly detached from Spanish politics anyway. We can't vote, at least people from the US can't, and for the most part, the government just ignores us. No political party is speaking to expat English teachers. Some of the Spanish teachers at the language school, on the other hand, had moved into tents out on the square to be part of the protest. It can't have been comfortable sleeping on granite for weeks, but at least their daily commute was reduced to a 1-minute walk. Presumably, they went home to shower from time to time. I don't think I ever asked. Protest tourism also became more popular. You'd be walking down La Castellana, and you'd suddenly find a few thousand coal miners from Asturias who'd come to shout outside some ministry. Or you'd find fruit growers handing out free oranges to protest low prices. The labor unions even organized a few general strikes around this time. But these were all pretty quiet affairs. I always went to work. Most of my students usually stayed home. The tent city in Seoul lasted for a few months. Eventually, the whole thing transformed into our current Unidas Podemos party. But that's a story for another day. Out of all of that time, what I most remember is a coworker of mine who would go down to the plaza twice a day. Some leftist group was giving out free food down there. "I'm gonna go get a sandwich," he'd say. "Want anything?" I didn't. "They're pretty bad," he would always say. "But free is free." Finally, brain drain, depression, and prostitution. Oh my. Many of my students during these times were serious 50-somethings in a serious corporate world. They would wear serious suits and we would meet in serious boardrooms. Thing was, every week there were fewer of them. Happy Monday! Where's Maria? I'd say, innocently rolling into the week's first class. Serious expressions around the boardroom table. Maria was fired last Friday. Next week, where's Tomas? Serious, somber faces. Tomas was fired last Friday. After a few weeks, I just stopped asking. And as soon as my writing business took off, I quit that job. Too much seriousness. In the meantime, though, the serious corporate types had told me all about their kids who are moving to Chile, to Dubai, to Beijing. Qualified young people who couldn't get an unpaid internship anywhere in Spain and had decided to leave. At the language school, the same thing happened. As the crisis dragged on, the classes started filling up with people whose plan was to get the fuck out of Dodge. Some of them ended up working at a Zara in London or an Amazon logistics center in Berlin, but at least they were working. The biggest irony, though, they couldn't get a job at Zara in Madrid without speaking English, French, German, and Mandarin. But applying to Zara in London, they found that even English was optional. I wrote a few articles about the brain drain back in those days. It all culminated with a piece I called Flight of the Party Girls, a response to a journalist who had just declared loudly that she was leaving for the greener pastures of Brazil. Why? Because Madrid just wasn't fun anymore. She was right, in a way. It certainly wasn't as fun as it used to be. Then again, life isn't just about fun. Anyway, the brain drain in Spain wasn't the worst of it. Around the same time, I saw ads for Spanish housewives prostituting themselves due to financial distress. Here's a pic I took in the old barrio way back in the day. You can see it on the blog. It says, Vallecas, apuradas españolas casadas, which I guess we could translate as married Spanish women fallen on hard times. Maximum discretion 24 hours a day. They'll even come to your house. There's a phone number. It's covered up by the car's windshield wiper in the photo, so I have no idea. They also promise an impossibly large chest measurement on these apuradas españolas casadas. I'm not sure how seriously to take the whole thing, but I guess there's something to it. An article in El País confirmed it. After several years in which a booming economy had them mostly out of the game, Spanish women were getting back into prostitution. That was another low point. But when did we get out of it? How exactly did the crisis end? Well, like I said, I got 3,000 words into this before realizing I had no idea. There wasn't really a big announcement that it was over. President Zapatero was voted out of office. He now says that claiming España no está en crisis for years on end was a mistake. Not a lie, but a mistake. The Partido Popular took over, led by a gaggle of gray-skinned zombies who would send out a list of decrees every Friday. Things really sucked balls for a while. Then they sucked a little bit less. So, what happened to get us out of it? Like I said, I'm not sure. It seems like things started to turn around when Mario Draghi said he was going to do whatever it took to keep the Eurozone together. Apparently, this meant he had lots of money as head of the European Central Bank to spend on buying Greek bonds to keep everyone solvent. It wasn't just Greece, of course. It was all the peripheral countries on Europe's second tier. The pigs, as they were lovingly called. Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. Pigs. Were kept afloat through those years by Draghi's liquidity injections. This same Mario Draghi later became Prime Minister of Italy and only resigned a couple of weeks ago. I'd mostly forgotten about him, but his signature is still on one of the 50s in my wallet. The Spanish government, of course, bailed out a lot of the banks, and there was a lot of consolidation as well. I find bank bailouts to be a bit dubious, but letting them all fail and then trying to pick our way out of the rubble seems unlikely to be much better. There's a book called The Great Depression, a diary, that describes what happened when the U.S. let the banks fail in the 30s. Short version, it wasn't pretty. But besides the bailouts, what happened? I still don't know. It seems like we were talking about the crisis every day for years, and we were. But at some point, we just stopped. You know how good news just seems to make a little bit less impact on your psyche than bad news does. I guess things just slowly got better. The job situation improved, bit by bit. At the time of this writing, we're actually at levels of unemployment resembling those previous to the whole Great Recession. But it's not like there was a giant headline saying, "Crisis over, thank God." Just like with the coronavirus, the news about the economy slowed to a trickle and was replaced by other, more pressing issues. In all of this, years passed. The king resigned, I dumped Marilia with a silent GL, and I quit my job. We got a new king, and I got a new girlfriend, or rather, a new series of girls I dated briefly. I moved north to the Tetuan neighborhood, and got and quit a series of other badly paid jobs. Things moved forward. The last crisis-y thing I remember happening was that Banco Santander bought out Banco Popular for the symbolic price of 1 euro in June 2017. I get the idea this was something they were forced to do, a new law in which banks would have to bail each other out rather than the government using public funds. And then, one day, we just weren't in crisis anymore. The US stock market had a really good decade from the 2009 crack until the lockdowns hit. Then there were a couple more good years after the huge 2020 crash. The US market is still, all told, doing pretty well. The Spanish market, like I said, is still in the tank. Take that as you will. The link between the stock market and the economy as a whole is tenuous at best. Did the Spaniards who left during the crisis ever come back? I sure know a lot who didn't. I know people who are still in Sweden or the Netherlands or Australia, because the Spanish economy, even during good times, is not all that amazing. Salaries aren't growing much, and it's unclear that they ever will. It's still hard for young people to leave their parents' house unless they're willing to share with a bunch of other people. And rent prices, apart from a slight drop during the COVID years, aren't exactly becoming more affordable. Add in the 10% inflation and, excellent job numbers aside, the feeling of optimism that a lot of people felt in 2005 hasn't returned. Or maybe I'm just feeling old. Old or not, I'm definitely part of a demographic. The people who were young during the crisis are still earning less than previous generations, according to the Bank of Spain. The same thing happened to people who came up during the Great Depression. It was a lost generation, and they never fully recovered. Anyway, we might be stoically facing a new recession soon. Speaking of stoicism, Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic Roman Empire, has a quote that I like a lot. "Never let the future disturb you," he says. "You will meet it, if you have to, with the same weapons of reason, which today arm you against the present." I know, guys with online businesses who do a lot of push-ups and talk about stoicism are something of a cliche these days. But I've gotten a lot throughout the years out of Seneca and Marcus Aurelius. Your mileage may vary. In any case, now the euro and the dollar are close to parity for the first time in 20 years. The war in Ukraine is dragging on, and there's bad news every day from some corner of the economy. What does it all mean in real terms? Probably nothing good, but I guess we'll muddle through one way or another, like we usually manage to do. Let's gird ourselves with those weapons of reason, like Marcus Aurelius says. It's going to be an interesting few years again. Here's to muddling. I told you that would be long. Thanks for listening to this podcast. For much more, you can head over to expatmadrid.com, where I write articles about all things Spain. You can donate to the cause at expatmadrid.com/donate. You could also subscribe to this podcast wherever it is you're listening, or over at the website, enter your email address for future updates. I hope you have a great day wherever you are in the world, and stay tuned for more Spain. Hasta la próxima, and bye.